Parsha, we're doing Parashat Ki Teitzei, and because our Parsha is so loaded, we will not do the Parsha summary in the beginning, where we usually do a quick overview of the mitzvot, but rather we'll go right into it because there are so many mitzvot. All we can do is an overview of the mitzvot. So the Torah tells us, Ki Teitzei LaMilchama Aloivecha, when you go out to war and you win the war, so there's a special mitzvah of Eishes Yifas Toar. Here the Torah tells us that sometimes a person is overtaken with passion, and the Torah says, don't do it. And ordinarily, we're supposed to prevent ourselves from entering the situation where we're overtaken with passion. So when you choose a college to go to, you go to a college with our good Jewish girls. And when you choose a fraternity to join, you join the one with our good Jewish girls. And when you choose a bar to go to, you say, well, there's no bar with good Jewish girls, so you don't go to the bar. So you go to a place where you will associate with people, where you will bump into people who you're supposed to bump into. And when you bump into them, when you go on a date with a girl, you don't go to a place where you'll be left alone. And you don't stay out late at night. And you don't go home to just see something in her apartment or show her something in your apartment. The Torah warns us to stay away from things, as we will see later in our parasha. And those who mock these mitzvot end up falling with these mitzvot. So the Torah always tells us, stay away from trouble. Lo tachmod. One of the Ten Commandments is, do not covet. A person will say, what do you want from me? It's my thought. What did I do? The Torah says, no. She's your neighbor's wife, right? Don't covet her. Eov, when he went dating, Eov says, I never looked at the girls I dated. Because maybe I won't end up marrying her, and then I'll think about her. So we have to look at the girl we're dating. But then there's looking, and there's looking. So Chazal told us, a person has to watch his eyes and be modest in his behavior, and ensure that he doesn't enter a situation which might overtake him. But what's he to do when he's out at war? And when they're out at war, so we know that at a time of war, we say, you don't even have to look for kosher food. If you're busy at war, you can't spend your time looking for kosher food. So Chazal told us, you're allowed to eat pig. You're in the middle of going house to house in Palestinian territory, and there's some pork sitting on their barbecue. And you're in that house waiting for the command to move on to the next house. So I don't know today, I don't know what we'd say. Because today, maybe it's just the heter pikuach nefesh, and maybe that's a blanket heter. I don't know if today we would say that. But in the time when we had an army under the auspices of a Jewish king doing things the way the halacha should say, so then you wouldn't have to think twice. You'd eat that pork and keep on fighting the war. Now what happens? In those times, the nations would dress up their girls at a time of war. And unfortunately, the Navi tells us the Jewish people did the same thing. The Navi in Isaiah tells us that the Jewish women, when we were being overtaken at the destruction of the first temple, the Jewish women thought, gee, well, we'll just seduce some soldiers and we'll be okay, even though Jerusalem's destroyed. And God says, no. God takes the 24 ornaments that a woman dons on herself, and God describes how each one he will overturn. He says, I'll make your hair go bald. I'll make you have your period just when you want to go. And one thing after another, I'll make it all go bad. And don't think you're going to be able to seduce the foreign soldiers. But this concept is a non-Jewish concept. This concept was one that we encountered when we'd go to war. So the non-Jews would dress up their girls, put on beautiful perfume. They'd say, go seduce a Jewish soldier. And unfortunately, the soldier is away from home, and he's there at battle, and he has no family. And the Torah knew that if the Torah tells him don't do it, he might not listen. So the Torah said, okay, if you see someone that really, really overtakes you, then the Torah says, I don't recommend it. It's not going to be good. But I'm not going to tell you no. You could take her one time alone in the tent and be with her. And afterwards, you decide if you want to marry her. So then there's the soul procession. You got to be human to her. Let her mourn her family. Let her mourn the fact that she's leaving her religion. She has to sit and take off all those beautiful clothing. Let her grow her nails in a fashion of mourning. Let her wear mourner's clothing. Let her shave her head. Let her sit in your house mourning over her family that she's about to leave and the religion she's about to leave. And after a month that you keep walking in and out and you see her crying like this and you see what you're doing to her and she's not so attractive, she's not wearing all the other stuff, so then you decide, do you still want to marry her? If you do, so then you take her and you get married. I'll get to you in 1 second. And if not, then send her. You can't say, well, now I'll sell you as a servant. Now you'll be my servant in my house. No. After what you did to her, the Torah says, you let her go. Now, you don't send her back to her father's house. We never encourage a non-Jew to go back to their pagan ways. So we don't send her, we don't tell her, here, I'll pay your taxes here. Go back to your father's house, go serve idols. No, that we won't do. We will make it possible for her to stay in the land of Israel and become a good kosher ger. But the Torah says, don't treat her lowly. You lived with her once. You tried to encourage her. You decided you don't want to live with her. You don't want her as a wife. Now you can't treat her in a lowly fashion. Yes?
What I was confused with is the soldier is allowed to have her for once. After that, he decides to take her with him to his birthday, to his home place. Or first he has to shave her head.
So that is a very good question. The Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud quotes in the name of Rav that he's allowed to be with her once, and afterwards they do this procession. And then the Jerusalem Talmud quotes from Rabbi Yochanan. We just learned Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was the great sage of Israel who composed the Jerusalem Talmud. That Rabbi Yochanan sent word to the Babylonian rabbis and said, you keep quoting in the name of your great rabbi Rav, who was the Babylonian rabbi, that he said this, that you're allowed to take her the first time into the tent, and only afterwards do you do the whole procession. Wrong. Rav Yochanan says, Rav never said it. You guys are in error, and you can't even go once with her before you do the whole procession. Do the whole procession, and then afterwards you take her as a wife. So there seems to be a disagreement between the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud as to whether we don't do either one, because we don't have all of these laws today.
Back then.
So most of the Rishonim go with the Babylonian Talmud. The Rambam very often we'll go with the Jerusalem Talmud, and if you're interested in why, bring it up on a Thursday night and we'll try to have a discussion about it. Yeah?
You can't have the union before marriage, I thought. So how could the union get into this one time?
So this is one time where the Torah permitted it. You're right. Ordinarily not. The Torah permitted it. We know that a Jew is not allowed to marry a non-Jewish woman. So how's he doing this? She hasn't yet become a Jew. The Torah says, on a one-time basis, I will permit it, because I know that if I tell him not, there's a good chance he won't listen. Now, King David didn't know that it's not recommended. He thought the Torah permits it. Good. So I'm doing it. And so he did it with Anasheh Sifas Torah, and then she became Jewish, and then she had a son who rebelled against him and turned the whole Jewish people against him and caused the civil war and killed many people and ended up dying himself without children. So our sages say, yeah, if you marry a woman who isn't where you are religiously, and she isn't where you are as far as family. She doesn't want to live with you. She doesn't want to be with your family. But somehow you got her to come. Well, that's the type of education she's going to give your kids. It's going to be half-hearted Jewish education. You can't marry a woman who's half-hearted in her observance unless you're half-hearted. So then maybe it works. But then you'll have half-hearted children. Yeah?
Is it unhalakhic to have a female soldier?
We'll get to that later. We'll get to that later. Okay. So, in short, we went quickly through some halachot. We'll continue. The Torah tells us if a person has one son that he likes more, one son that he likes less, the Torah tells us he lo yuchal, he may not switch around the order of inheritance. There's a way the Torah wanted inheritances to work, and we may not switch it around. And it's interesting that the word lo yuchal in modern Hebrew means he cannot. When you ask someone, could you lift that? And he says, ani lo yachol, I cannot. It means he physically cannot. And when the Torah says lo yuchal, the Torah is, so to speak, exaggerating the term. It's saying he may not. He doesn't have the permission to. It doesn't mean he physically cannot, but he may not. Yeah?
I can come up with three instances, four cases now, when I think about it, where in Torah, the younger son was respected more and considered to be the Makar. More like straight out, Yitzhak over Ishmael, Yaakov over Esau, Menashe over the prime over Menashe, and then again Moshe over Aaron.
Okay, so here we're talking about inheritance. If during their lifetime, of course, the younger son can outscore the older son. There's even an interesting tshuva in the Rosh, that in the Rama. The Rama writes, what if the younger sibling is a big Talmud Chacham and the older sibling is not? And he doesn't respect the younger sibling. He curses him out. So the Rama writes, we put him in ostracism. What kind of chutzpah is that? Just because he's younger than you means that you're greater than him. You're older than him. You're given certain rights in the Torah. And he has to show you certain respect. But if he's gained a position, he knows Torah, so you owe him the respect for the Torah. Moshe was greater than Aaron in his Torah, so he was a greater prophet. Ephraim was greater than Menashe, so he was greater. In their lifetime, they could attain great heights. The Torah is talking about inheritance. There's a special law about inheritance. The Torah then tells us that if one has this rebellious son, and there are many, many technicalities to how this rebellious son can really come to be, so then there's a possibility that the kid gets the death penalty. What did this kid do so terrible? He didn't do anything so terrible. But he's showing signs that he's going to end up being a major bandit. So we say nip it at the bud. Is this a concept that we would say on our own? For sure not. Is this a concept that was ever implemented? The Gemara says, according to one opinion, never happened. Because there are so many technicalities as to what has to happen. It's only at a specific time, only at specific months, when the child is a specific age, from the time he brought 2 years, till the time he's a real major, till the time he's a real gadol, and it has to be that both parents are of equal height, they have the same voice. There's so many technicalities that it almost is impossible for it to really happen. But the Torah teaches us many lessons in chinuch with these laws. The Torah tells us that parents have to be equal in the way they raise their kids. It's not good when you have parents or one parent says, you don't watch TV, and then they walk out of the house and the wife, when the husband isn't home, she sits him down in front of the TV, she needs to get her job done. It's not easy being a mother, but there has to be an equal path in chinuch. We have to be on the same wavelength. And the Torah teaches us many things. That from this parsha, we learn the things that a family has to focus on in how to raise their children, how to be equal in teaching their children. A quick concept in chinuch of a child. In a child's mind, daddy's right and mommy's right. So if mommy and daddy are disagreeing, I'm giving him a contradiction in terms. Then there's right and right. Well, right and right are contradictory, and he doesn't know what to do with it. So that's something for us to think about. The best investment a person can make in his child's chinuch is to have good shalom bayis. The Torah tells us that there are instances where a person gets hanged, and there are two opinions. One opinion says that everyone who gets the death penalty of stoning gets hanged, and we don't go with that opinion. We say that the only person that gets hanged are a person who blasphemes and a person who serves idol worship. Those are the only two that get hanged. So if you leave such a person hanging, what's going to happen? People are going to say, why is he hanging? So everyone's going to say, oh, you know, he saw this idol, this Zeus. He prayed to Zeus and suddenly lightning came down and a pot of gold appeared before him and he believed in it. So people are going to talk about all kinds of why this guy's hanging, why he got the death penalty. And that's really blaspheming in and of itself. Sometimes the mere discussion of something is destructive. So God says, don't leave him hanging for too long. And that's really the way we do it. If a person ever deserved hanging, they'd hang him a few minutes before sunset and then they'd take him down. So that they'd fulfill the verse, but in its minimal fashion. So the Torah says, don't leave him hanging. And we know that we learned last week about King Saul's children that were taken by the Givonim, and the Givonim hung them, and they remained hanging all summer long. The question is, how could they do that? Torah says you don't leave a body hanging overnight. So one understanding is, that wasn't our responsibility. The Givonim took them and hung them. The Torah says, when you hang someone, when the Jewish court hangs someone, they have to take him down, don't leave him hanging at night. The Jerusalem Talmud gives another understanding. The Jerusalem Talmud says, we have two concepts in Allah. We have a concept of Kiddush Hashem and a concept of Chil Hashem. If you walk into a store and there's an old lady and she needs help with her bags and you go and help her and people say, ah, look at that guy, that's how Ephraim Jew behaves. So you made a Kiddush Hashem. If you walk into a store and you cut the line and people look and they say, ah, that's how Ephraim Jew behaves. So that's a Chilul Hashem. So sometimes we think they're equal. It's just one's the positive, one's the negative. And the Jerusalem Talmud says that from this story of King Saul's children that were left hanging, we see that Kiddush Hashem is greater than Chilul Hashem. The Torah tells us you leave the body hanging, that's a desecration of God's name. And when they left those bodies hanging, so we discussed then, it was tremendous Kiddush Hashem. People said, look at how the Jews treat Gerim. Here you have Gerim that tricked them into joining the Jewish people, the Givonim. And even so, because King Saul, who was the king, wronged them, the Jewish people let them avenge the death of 7 of their relatives from the family of nobility. And they were King David's family as well, because we know David HaMelech was Shaul's son-in-law. So they were his relatives as well. And this was a tremendous Kiddush Hashem. We discussed that there were thousands of people that became Gerim because of this Kiddush Hashem. The whole world was in shock over the treatment that Jews give the Gerim. So the Jerusalem Talmud says the reason they let it happen was because Kiddush Hashem outweighs Chilul Hashem. That is why they let those bodies stay hanging throughout the summer. The Torah tells us if we encounter a lost item, so can you disregard it, says the Torah questioningly. V'italam tamim, would you disregard it? No! Bring back the lost item to your friend. So from the fact that the Torah said it in a questioning manner, would you disregard it? We learn that, yeah, sometimes you do. Let's say you're an old man, and there's a comic book lying on the floor. So you don't want to be seen with comic books. You'd never buy a comic book for your grandson. So then we say, you don't have to bend down and pick up that comic book. You walk by and there's a practical joke on the floor. So you know someone lost it. But you don't want to be seen with those things. So the Torah says, if it's something that's beneath your dignity, so then you don't have to do it. Let's say you're Bill Gates. Every minute of yours is worth $100. And you see someone dropped a $2 bill. Until you pick it up and verify whose it is, well, it's going to take you a few minutes, right? Your time is more valuable than his lost object. So the Torah says, when your time is more valuable, you don't have to deal with it. And that can be relevant here as well. I mean, you see a pen on the floor. By the time you find out whose pen it is, how much is that pen worth? 2 shekel? It's a used pen. 1 shekel? 50 agurot? Your time very often can be far more valuable than that lost item. So that's why the Torah words it, would you disregard it? And the answer is sometimes yes, and sometimes no. Ordinarily, no. But there can be instances when, yeah, disregard it. It's not worth your time. You're driving down the highway, and you see someone's umbrella on the side. By the time you get off the next exit, come back, go see that umbrella, the amount of gas it cost you, aside from your time, is more than that umbrella. So don't go for that umbrella. No. Yeah.
What do you do if you find money on the street? Obviously, it's been there for a while. You don't know whose it is. It's a lot of money.
So this class is not a class in halacha, but ordinarily we say money, there is no siman. If you find money in a wallet, so that's one thing. If you find money in it, there's a note around it, so that's one thing. But if it's just money, so you got to check that it's not booby-trapped. Sometimes terrorists put booby-trapped money to make a bomb go off. And then you got to just make sure that it's legal money.
No, I mean, you're allowed to keep it.
But technically, yeah. Halachically, money has no siman. You're allowed to keep the money, yeah.
I'm just wondering, I know that you said the class is not about halacha, but there's a mitzvah to return the lost object. Right, so how do you, is there a way of weighing up what is not worth the time?
We say you evaluate how much your time is worth, or if it's beneath your dignity. Let's say your neighbor's garbage cans fly out into the street. And you're the chief rabbi of Israel. You don't go collecting your own garbage cans from the street.
Sure.
So then you'll ask someone else to take care of the garbage cans, or you won't.
Okay.
But you don't have to do something that you wouldn't do for yourself.
Okay.
Yeah. What happens if you have a neighbor who his garbage cans are always flying into the streets? So you bring them back, and they go out again. You bring them back, and they go out again. So the Torah tells us even 4 or 5 times, provided that's not his negligence. He's not letting it just go. He's doing what he could, but somehow the garbage men always leave it out or something like that. So then there's no limit. You have to bring it back even 100 times. Shav Saveda, you have to give it back. Now, you don't have to come knocking on his door and tell him, Shmuel, here are your garbage cans. No. The second you put it in his domain in a way that it's there and it won't go away, once it's protected in his domain, then that's enough. He doesn't have to know about it. Now, the Torah says, wait until he seeks it out, and our sages have on tradition, you seek him out. What does it mean? I don't have to go looking for him. He has to look for me. But when he comes to collect, we have to suspect maybe he's a swindler. So the Torah says, you seek him out. Question him. Give me a sign. How do I know it's yours? So if you find an object, don't post a sign, I found a wallet with $20 in it. You say, I found a sum of money. A person comes and says, I lost a sum of money. So you tell him how much? So he says, $100. So you say, it's not yours. So he says, wait, 22. So you say, what do you mean 22? You said 100. So you check him out. Torah says, you have to worry for swindlers. And that's what we discussed last week. Tamim tiyem Hashem. With Hashem, you have to be whole, believing. With your fellow man, don't be stupid. With God, you shouldn't be stupid either. But with God, there's an aspect of believing, being whole with God. With your fellow man, you should be suspicious. You have to honor your fellow man, kapdeu, v'chashdeu, and suspect him. This goes for everyone. You give someone a loan, write a contract. You don't want to write a contract, you're going against our sages. Our sages said, you give a loan, write a contract. So here the Torah tells us, a guy's coming to collect an item, he says, I lost it. So you ask him, okay, prove it, tell me. give me a sign. What sign does it have? And this is the, what we call siman. Siman is a sign. And this goes so far as to say that you don't return an object unless it has simanim. If it has no siman, then you don't return it. Now, what constitutes a siman? So siman could be a name on it, a sign on it, something unique about it, the way it was wrapped, the place it was placed, the way in which it was placed. The Gemara in El Mitzis goes through all the laws of what constitutes a siman. The Torah tells us that a man may not wear a woman's garment. And this applies not only to garments, but it also applies to ways people take care of themselves. So our sages said a man may not pluck out his white hairs. That's considered a female thing to do. A man may not dye his hair. That's this prohibition. If a person shaves his hair, we're not talking about his facial hair. He shaves his armpit, he shaves his private parts. That's considered a female thing to do. And that's this prohibition, that a man is not supposed to do things that are a female's way of dressing up. And the same thing is true for a woman. Now, this applies to things that have to do with the way we dress, with this applies also to weapons. That's what Zach asked earlier. May a woman go to war? So we say that at a time of war, if it's necessary, so women will participate in a modest fashion. They'll help bake the food. They'll help prepare the clothing. There's a lot of work that they could do. But they're not going to be in the front lines. And that's why when we had Yael, who killed the chief general Sisera, she didn't take a sword in her hand. What did she take? She took the spoke. She took the spoke because as a woman, she preferred to do it in a modest way. If she had no choice, she would have taken a sword. But when it's not absolutely necessary, so they shouldn't carry firearms either, because that's usually a male thing. Rabbi Feinstein has a response where he writes that women in the yeshuvim, where it's necessary, then they could carry a gun in their purse. If they need to carry a gun on them, they could carry a gun. Yeah. So I have to look it up. I don't want to tell you something off the cuff. His question is, it says in the laws of Purim that on Purim we do get dressed up, men as women, women as men, and we have certain leniencies towards this halacha. Yeah, but he's asking, why are we lenient with something that's biblical?
Then I'm saying that you're not technically dressing up like a woman per se, there's still a difference. That's what someone told me when I asked that
question. Okay, I want to look it up before I answer. I want to look into it again. Now, what happens if your wife has warm slippers and you want to wear them? It's a cold winter night, and she asks you, could you get me a drink? And you say, well, you know, the floor is pretty cold here. I'll go, but I'm putting on your slippers. So the halacha says that things that are for warmth, there it's not a problem. Like anything that's for warmth, if you want to go take out the garbage and her coat is handy, so you can wear her pink coat. Things that are for warmth, so that's...
Can you take advantage of that ever?
Sure, yeah.
Yes, you get to wear your pink jacket.
Okay, the Torah tells us that if we build a house, we have to put a maket, a railing on the roof, so that people don't fall off it. And this applies to anything that's dangerous in our house. We have a biblical commandment to remove danger spots from our home. So let's say you pull the plug out of the wall, and suddenly the socket comes out a little bit. So the socket is out. So you tell yourself, I won't stick my finger into the socket. But you have a 5-year-old kid who's going to be very curious in sticking his finger into that socket. So the halacha says anything that might pose a danger must be taken care of right away. You don't leave around something that could be dangerous. So that's this commandment. The commandment technically speaks about a railing, that you, if you have a flat rooftop, you're going to go on that rooftop. You use that rooftop, you have to have makeh, you have to have a railing to ensure that people don't fall off. But the Torah continues and says, do not leave a source of spilling blood in your home. And that's a reference to anything. Let's say you have a ladder that's rickety. You don't leave a rickety ladder in your house. And Chazal said that this applies also to a vicious dog. Let's say you have a dog that's vicious, that he could bite up the mailman. So Chazal say you don't have a Rottweiler in your house. I mean, maybe you have a tame Rottweiler, I don't know. But what I know is that the Nazis brought up Rottweilers because they're notorious for being vicious. So you're not allowed to bring up within your home something that's harmful. The Gemara brings a story that a guy had a vicious dog, and a pregnant woman walked by, and he barked at her and scared the wits out of her. And the guy said, "Don't worry, he's held up tight." So she said, "Go throw your comforts to the wind, to the bushes, because I already feel the baby came out of fear. The baby's on its way out, I'm miscarrying." So Chazal tell us that a person who has a dog that might scare people, he must chain up that dog in a way that people see. Some people have vicious dogs, and then they have those invisible fences. You know what I'm talking about? They have those fences that the dog senses. There's some kind of signal that if he goes beyond that, he doesn't go beyond that. But people don't see it. That's not good enough. Because when he chumps and barks at people, they don't know that he's not going to attack them. You're not allowed to scare people either. So you have to have a chain that people see. You have to see something. I love the way people say, "Don't worry, he doesn't bite." You know, you walk by, they're not holding their dog on a leash. You're walking through the park and he's running around barking at you, and they tell you, "Don't worry, he doesn't bite." Well, that's against halacha. The second I'm worried he might bite me, then you have to chain him in a way that I'm confident that he won't. So the Torah says, don't leave a source of bloodshed in your house, and this applies to anything that can cause harm to other people, to ourselves or other people. Yeah.
I was going to say, are you allowed to move into a house which is not fully built then? Like, you've got a new house which is just been built, but it's not fully ready.
So ensure that it's not dangerous. You have to know that the responsibility of building a makeh is on the tenant. I once went to check out an apartment, and the landlord, I saw that there was a part of the yard where there was suddenly a 15-foot drop. So I asked the landlord, "What?" And he was a religious Jew. I said, what about that? So he says, "Yeah, what's the problem?" So I said, "Well, kids play in the yard." So he said, "Yeah." So I said, "That's dangerous." So he said, "Yeah." So I said, "Come on, but there's a mitzvah that you have to build a railing." So he said, "Yeah, that's not my responsibility. It's the tenant's responsibility." So he's right. That is the halacha. It's also the halacha that the tenant has to ensure that there are kosher mezuzahs. So this same landlord didn't have kosher mezuzahs. So I said to him, "If I move in, are you going to put in kosher mezuzahs?" So he said, "That's not my responsibility." And that's very nice. But you have to know this before you take an apartment, because mezuzahs can cost you 100, 150 shekel a mezuzah. And that's talking about used mezuzahs. And a railing is going to cost you money. So even though technically, halachically, you're responsible for it, but that's a lot of money. You could end up spending 1,000 shekel just on mezuzahs when you move into an apartment. Yeah?
So when you build a house, you put it to the owner, not the tenant?
So we say no.
So even as the landlord, he's not accountable?
Right. Wow. It's the tenant's responsibility, yeah.
Sorry, I just wanted to ask you about the having a dog in a Jewish home. Might be like deemed inappropriate to have such animal.
People say it's inappropriate to raise a dog in your home. They say it's kabbalistically inappropriate. The Gemara in Shabbos says that David HaMelech had a dog in his house. Dogs, multiple. David HaMelech had dogs. So I don't know.
He had a palace.
He had a palace, but Shlomo, his 12-year-old son, knew what was doing with the dogs. You'd think the prince didn't know what was doing with the dogs. It says that David HaMelech died on Shabbos, and Shlomo was wondering, what am I supposed to do? He sent a question to the rabbis, and he said, Dad died, King David died, it's Shabbos afternoon, and his body is out in the sun, and it's not nice that the body should sit in the sun, and the dogs are hungry. How am I supposed to feed the dogs, halachically, on Shabbos, and how am I supposed to take care of Dad's body? So they told him, your father's body, place a loaf of bread on it, or place a baby on it, and then you can move it, because then you're carrying something that's not muktzah with that, and the dogs you feed as is. And that's why King Solomon said in Koheles, he said, "Akelev achai, the live dog, utov min ha'yav met, is better than the lion that's dead. My father, the lion, he's dead. I can't carry him straight. I have to place something on him and then carry him, then move him out of the sun. The dogs, they're alive, so I could feed them as is. I don't have to figure out ways of bringing them food." Okay, let's continue. So So we're continuing in our parsha, and we said we have the mitzvah that a person is not supposed to wear female's clothing. Then we have the mitzvah that we have to ensure that we have no source of bloodshed in our home. Give me just 1 second, please. Okay. we're going slightly out of order. The Torah tells us that if we see someone's animal that's having trouble under a load, we have to help him out. We can't turn a blind eye, and this is the concept of Tzar Bali Chaim also. The concept that you see an animal suffering, you have to try and help it out. By the way, when we said men may not wear women's clothing, it also applies to women wearing men's clothing. It goes both ways. Now, part of this is that we don't want that people get dressed up as people of the other gender, and then they go and they could do all kinds of improper things. We have a commandment: if one sees a mother bird with its baby birds, so don't take the babies or the eggs in front of the mother. That's not nice. Send the mother away and then take the babies. So that's a mitzvah of shiluach haken, sending the mother from the nest. Ken is a nest, shiluach is to send away. And we don't know exactly what the idea is behind this mitzvah, but it has deep Kabbalistic meanings. And the Torah tells us that for this easy mitzvah, that when you want to take eggs, don't do it in front of the mother. First send the mother away and then take the eggs. For this easy mitzvah, we get to have longevity, and obviously longevity means in the world to come, not in this world. Yeah?
Okay, how come Shlokim the Chorus is not a Sa'ad
Ha'alai? The chicken doesn't look like they're scared. They look like they're scared. Let me ask you a different question. How come slaughtering an animal isn't Sa'ad Ba'alai Chaim? The chicken isn't very happy when you're doing that.
Yeah, but that's
the oh, so here it also has a purpose. The purpose is that when we do kaparos, it's a custom, and it's to get us to do tshuva, and we're saying that the chicken is, we cannot bring karbanos today, but we this is supposed to move us, just like when we bring a karban. We lean on the animal, and then we slaughter the animal. It's not a nice thing to do, believe me, but we say it's part of the service of Hashem. So those who have the custom to do it with money, do it with money, but if this is one's custom, so fine. And if you don't like the custom, don't worry, the Shulchan Aruch didn't like it either. But it doesn't help you because you see that the custom took root and everyone does do it. I don't know. I mean, every chicken you buy in the store is also treated horribly. You know why their meat is soft? Because they leave them in a small cage where they could hardly move their whole life, so everything remains soft. Okay. Okay, let's continue. So the Torah tells us we are not allowed to plant kilayim. Kilayim means a mixture of two different types of seeds. So the Torah tells us the prohibition of kilayim in Israel. So if you have a vineyard, you're not allowed to take a wheat kernel together with a barley kernel and plant them in that vineyard. That's a special prohibition. Ordinarily, there's kilayim planting two seeds together. Then there's kilayim in a vineyard, which means two seeds within a vineyard. so that's its own prohibition, and if one does kilayim in a vineyard, so then the things that grow are prohibited from having any joy. You're not allowed to derive any benefit from it. It's considered too kadash. It's prohibited from any pleasure. and the courts used to send out their messengers to check out people's fields to make sure they're complying with this commandment. Now this applies also for grafting. If you want to graft two trees, so you have to graft trees that are not kilayim. And it's interesting that this applies even to non-Jewish workers in your field. A non-Jewish worker in one's field is also not allowed to do kilayim. And then the Torah tells us kilayim with two animals. You're not allowed to take two animals and work with them in the field together, because then you're accustoming them to be together and ultimately they might mate. So this even applies if one is pulling the plow in the front, one's pulling it in the back, one's pulling the wagon in the front, one's in the back. And according to some opinions, there seems to be a Jerusalem Talmud that says it even applies if you're holding the reins to your horse and you're hunting, let's say, and you're holding the reins to your dog as you're running along. So the horse is pulling you along, the dog isn't pulling you along. You know, when they go hunting, so they used to go with the dog. So you're holding the dog on a leash and you're holding the horse by its reins. So you're holding both of them. So the Jerusalem Talmud says that too is in transgression of the concept of kilayim, and that needs work. How do we understand that and how do we apply that? Now another type of kilayim is kilayim in our clothing. We're prohibited from wearing shatnez. Now shatnez is wool and linen together. We don't know what's in our clothing. If you look at the label, they sometimes say cashmere. There's no cashmere there. Go to the store right here, 2 minutes away. They'll sell you cashmere for 25 shekel. I'm willing to bet any amount of money that I could afford, that there's not a stitch of cashmere there if they're selling it to you for 25 shekel. But this is an issue which the governments don't really monitor at all. You could buy a suit that says 100% wool, and when you'll check, you'll see it's very far from 100% wool. What?
In the US, anything containing less than 2% of the material doesn't have to be missing.
I have a friend who went to the Shatner's laboratory, and he brought a suit that said it had 70 or 80% wool, and the guy told him, there ain't no 70, 80% wool in this suit. You want to sue them, you can sue them, but there's nowhere near it. And he told him that he sees it all the time, that the government doesn't really monitor what they write on the labels. So this is definitely true in Israel as well. I don't know what the deal is in Europe. But when you buy a garment that has wool in it, so you have to worry that maybe there's some linen in it, because they use linen. Linen is strong. They use it for the buttons. They use it sometimes for the lapel. Sometimes they use it to give strength to the fiber in the back. The ties that they manufacture in Spain, they use it for the filler inside the tie. So we can't know what has an issue of shatnez or not. There are shatnez laboratories. Some of them will let you call in and ask your questions, and some do not. You have to know that women's clothing also, if they have wool or linen in them, you have to check either one. Most often, you don't find shatnez in a garment that is not very expensive. Usually, you buy a Hugo Boss suit. There, we know that many of the Hugo Boss suits have linen in them. So that's a suit that you're buying for $800. You buy a suit for $100, the likelihood of finding shatnez in there is close to no. But you see that people still take them to be checked, and one should preferably take his garments that have wool or linen in them and ask if they need to be checked. The Torah tells us that if a person marries a girl and he doesn't like her and he hates her, and then he decides to give her a bad name, he's a Motzi Shemra. He comes to the court and says, you know, this girl, she went with another guy in between our Kiddushin and Nisuin. We know in ancient times the way they used to marry was they did Kiddushin, which is the first step of marriage, and then they'd wait a year and do Nisuin. We do both under the Chuppah, the two stages of marriage. But in ancient times they used to do Kiddushin, pause a year, and then do Nisuin. And he says during that year she went with another man, and he's lying. And the courts can verify that he's lying, so then they punish him, they tax him, and he's prohibited from ever divorcing her again in his life. He has to remain married to her so long as she wants to remain married to him. And here we see a few concepts. First of all, we have the concept of Motzi Shemra, which is a prohibition. You're not allowed to give someone a bad name. You're not allowed to say something falsely bad about a person. This is separate from the prohibition of Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara, we know there are certain leniencies. If it's something that's famous, everyone knows about it, you could say it. Motzi Shemra, that you have no permission to say ever. It's a lie. Just because everyone's saying a lie doesn't mean you could repeat it. Motzi Shemra is when you're giving someone a bad name. And Lashon Hara, even when we permit Lashon Hara, it's only when you're not looking to spread the bad name. They say so-and-so, everyone saw him driving on Shabbos. Okay, so if you say it in passing because everyone knows it, that's fine. But if you say it purposely to make people know that he was driving on Shabbos, even though a lot of people know it, that's still prohibited. Yeah. Okay. So the Torah tells us, let's say a person engages a girl, technically they're married, they do kiddushin, and then the girl is forcibly taken by another man, so he can get the death penalty, depending on what happens. And she, don't do anything to her. And here we have the concept, onos rachmana patre, when something is done against someone's will.
Engaged or married, sir.
So engaged in the Torah as well is almost married. Engaged halachically, it means almost married. The rabbis, technically, biblically, once they're engaged halachically, which is what we put the ring on our finger, yeah, in front of witnesses, and we say, I'm hereby engaging you, arat mikudesh et li, I'm engaging you halachically, not what we call engagement today. So technically, they're married. The rabbis said they're not allowed to live together until they have proper nisuin. But technically, from that moment on, biblically, they would be allowed to live together, provided she's not a nida, provided she went to mikveh, etc. But that today, none of this happens. When we get engaged today, it's a borrowed term, our engagement. We get engaged, it just means we've decided we will get married one day. That's very nice. That has no halachic implications, almost no halachic implications. So the Torah tells us, how did this guy come to a point where he's willing to speak badly about his wife, and if what he says is validated, she'll get executed? She's a married woman who lived with another guy. That's what he's claiming she did. So the Torah says it all began with the fact that he transgressed the commandment, "Ve'ahavta le'racha kamocha," love your fellow man, which applies first and foremost to one's wife. We think, love your fellow man. He comes into class, say hello to him, give him a candy, treat him nicely. No, v'ahavta re'acha kamocha begins at home. Begins with your wife. V'ahavta re'acha kamocha begins with one's wife. And our sages said that if one does not fulfill the minimum v'ahavta re'acha kamocha to his wife, then he could come to the point where usne'a, where he hates her, and he could even come to a point where he wishes her dead. So the Torah describes that. Here's a guy, he just married a girl, and now he's walking into court and saying, she went off with another man, and that's why she wasn't a virgin, and he's trying to get her to bump her off. So the Torah says, yeah, that can happen. How does it all begin? Well, we don't live up to our commandment of loving our fellow man like ourselves with regard to our wives. So the Torah tells us, Anos Rachmana Patri, if something happens against someone's better will, the Torah doesn't hold him accountable, and we have to treat him the same. Can't hold it against him. Sometimes we're not that way. Sometimes we think we're more zealous than the Torah. The Torah tells us, no. If he did his best, something happened, it's not his fault. The Torah commands us that a person who's castrated is not allowed to marry into the Jewish people. A person who's a mamzer, a bastard, a brother and a sister live together, a married woman committed adultery and had a child. So that child is a mamzer, he's a bastard, he's not allowed to marry into the Jewish people. Ammonite or a Moabite are not allowed to marry into the Jewish people, and we're not supposed to make peace with them. Now, Ammonites and Moabites, we don't know who they are anymore. In the time of the first temple, there was a king called Sancheriv, and he had this tactic that every country that he'd conquer, he'd exile them and move them to somewhere else, and this was a very good tactic. It made them miserable, but it also made them powerless to rebel against him. So, when he moved around every country, so there are no longer Ammonites, Moabites, Mitzrim, Amalek. We don't know who anyone is. We skipped a very important mitzvah. The Torah tells us that we have a mitzvah of wearing tzitzis. So that's a very important mitzvah. Chazal tells us that this mitzvah protects us. If you do not wear a four-cornered garment, you don't have to wear tzitzis. If wearing tzitzis causes you to have difficulty in concentrating in the middle of the summer, in the heat of the summer, don't wear tzitzis. You don't have to wear tzitzis every minute. But when you do wear tzitzis, Chazal tells us it's a mitzvah that protects you. And the custom is to wear tzitzis every day. At least one should wear talis for davening. And really, you see, everyone does wear tzitzis. One should ideally wear tzitzis. One does not have to leave the strings out. According to the Kabbalists, you leave the strings in. According to others, you leave the strings out. You don't have to. If it bothers you to leave the strings out, that's not a reason not to wear tzitzis. Leave them in. But you should wear tzitzis. Now, the tzitzis are supposed to hang on the corner. Meaning, you could put the tzitzis so that they're hanging down beneath the corner, or you could put the tzitzis so they're hanging out and they're lying on the corner. That's the way they should be. The tzitzis should be lying on the corner. Yes? Go ahead, yeah.
Sorry, I just wanted to ask you about this. Now, I believe that wearing tzitzis, you don't have to. Is it rishus, not wearing tzitzis at night? Or is that is it a rebellion?
So that's a disagreement whether Rambam and Rush, do we say that one does not have to wear tzitzis at all at night, or did the Gemara mean that if you have a garment that you wear only at night, like a pajamas, that has four corners, that type of garment does not require tzitzis?
Right.
Two understandings. So we don't make a blessing on tzitzis at night, but we do, if we could, we wear tzitzis at night. There is an opinion that says you're obligated.
Right.
But the whole concept of tzitzis, when you do it, you're performing a biblical mitzvah. So why not?
Morning, we were reading this really old version of Barn, and the thing crushed pretty. So, just say you crushed your genitalia.
We're getting to that. That's the next thing. We're getting to that right now.
Well, you said eunuchs before, so I was just.
That's something else.
Okay.
We'll get to that. So, now that. Yeah. Depends on how long you left it off for. If you left it off, if you took it off for a second, then that's one thing. But if you took off your tzitzit and you went to eat lunch and you come back, then you make another blessing. Also, you make another blessing, yes. Anything substantial where you really took it off and you didn't think of putting it back on. And if you took off your talit katan, if you took off your talis, so then there's an opinion that says so long as you're wearing talit katan, that's okay. But even there are opinions that say you do make a blessing. But if you took off your talit katan and it's not with the intent to put it right back on, so then you make a blessing when you put it back on again. The Torah tells us that if a person has his gonads crushed, So he's not allowed to marry into the Jewish people. And this, unfortunately, is something that can happen naturally. Sometimes people wake up one day, they're 35, 40, and they find they're missing one gonet. It can happen. So a person has to ask a halachic shayla. Very often, when it happens naturally, he will be permitted to remain married, but one has to ask. There's another thing that's called the chut shofcha, that a person has his, the aver, is not allowed to marry a Jew. He's allowed to marry a ger. He's allowed to marry specific people, but he's not allowed to marry an ordinary Jew, or remain living with an ordinary Jew. The next thing is a chut shafcha, which means that you have the aver, we'll call it the bris mila, just to use a pure lashon, and there's a slit in the aver, so that when he goes to the bathroom, instead of it shooting out, he dribbles. And that's why when we go to the bathroom, we're supposed to ensure that there are no drops on the floor, so that people won't think that so-and-so dribbles. But public bathrooms, it's less of a problem. They won't think it's you. They'll think someone else left a puddle. But it's still not nice. If you left a puddle, clean up after yourself. But back to the... I wouldn't think I have to say it, but I go into the public bathrooms here, and almost always there's something there.
There's always where to pay.
So I'm mentioning it. But back to the Torah, what the Torah is telling us. The Torah tells us that a person who has a slit, so he can't shoot out, his seed is not going to shoot out, so that person is not allowed to marry into the Jewish people, but that is fixable medically. In the times of the Gemara, it was fixable, and today it's fixable. And there's a condition called hypospadias, where a child is born and everything looks normal, but the hole is not at the tip. The hole could be anywhere along the aver or even further back. So that's a medical condition. It's 1 in 200 children that are born this way. And the way I'm a moel, that's why I'm telling you about it. Every so often we get a case like this that needs a circumcision. So the way they do it today is, you guys know how a drill works when you open up a drill. So they. Okay. Said anyways, they do reconstructive surgery. Today they could perfect it. They know how to do reconstructive surgery. There's no problem with it, and there's no problem with this concept either, because the Gemara tells us that so long as right now the child can function normally, so then he's not a chut shofcha. Let's continue. Okay. The Torah tells us, why are the Ammonites and Moabites not permitted to marry into the Jewish people? Because they boycotted us. When we left Egypt, they made a boycott, and they wouldn't let us buy food or water from them, and they hired Bilam to curse us. Makes you think, you guys know Coke and Pepsi, you remember the old boycott? It's something to think about. The Torah takes a boycott seriously. The Torah tells us, do not seek their peace forever. And when David HaMelech did not obey this commandment, he caused a massive war that almost... That had tremendous repercussions, threatened the annihilation of the Jewish people, because he was extra kind to the Ammonites. And God said, what should being so kind to them for? I told you not to. Torah tells us, when we go out to war, we have to watch ourselves from anything that's bad. What does that mean, anything that's bad? So here, the Torah continues and says, let's say a person is impure from something that occurred at night. So that's a reference to Tumas Keri. What is Tumas Keri? Person emits sperm, either with his wife or not with his wife. We know that a person is not permitted to emit his sperm voluntarily. He's not supposed to cause any sperm to come out when it's not for the purpose of being with his wife. So this concept, we applied... if he's with his wife, no problem. But if he's if the sperm comes out and it's for naught, so that's a biblical prohibition. So when the Torah says, watch yourself from anything that's bad... That's a reference to a person thinking thoughts during the day that cause him to be hard, and then ultimately by night he's going to emit sperm involuntarily. But here we learn a very important halacha, that the prohibition of hotza'at shechvat zera levatala, emitting sperm for naught, is a more serious prohibition, in that in ordinary prohibitions we say, if I do something that causes it second degree, I'm not held responsible. But here we say, if you looked at something or thought something by day, and then at night it came back to haunt you, that you transgressed that biblical prohibition. Now this is relevant to people who have fertility issues. Sometimes the doctors will say, we want to check his sperm count. So they say, we need a sampling of the sperm. So a person says, fine. We say, no, it's not so fine. You have to figure out a way, halachically, how to do it. We don't just emit sperm for the heck of it. You're not allowed to. It's biblically prohibited to cause any sperm to come out. So there are tests that we do, and if it's necessary, we figure out ways of doing it in fashions that are halachically correct. But one has to know that this prohibition is very, very weighty. The prohibition of emitting sperm is not only directly, one's not allowed to masturbate, but it's even indirectly, we're not allowed to allow ourselves to become hard during the day, because if one does that by day, then chances are by night he will end up emitting sperm. And in the Zohar, there's tremendous works. The Beis Yosef wrote a corrections, so to speak, on his Beis Yosef. Rav Yosef Karo wrote his great work, the Shulchan Aruch, and he wrote his even greater work called the Beis Yosef, which is the commentary on the tour. And then he added revisions called the Bedek Abayis. So in his revisions on these laws, he quotes a Zohar that says, this is the weightiest sin that exists. This is the biggest sin that exists. Obviously, that's an exaggeration. If one is in a situation where he feels his desire is overtaking him and he's going to do a bigger sin, let's say one is newly married and he's prohibited to be with his wife. Let's say the woman is Nida. They're prohibited to be together. And he feels desire overtaking him. So then we would say, go and masturbate. And that's a lesser prohibition than this prohibition. Ordinarily, it's biblically prohibited to masturbate. But if a person feels like that's it, he's going to lose it, so we say don't lose it. Even though the Zohar says this is the weightiest sin that exists, we say yes, it's the weightiest sin that exists, but that's on spiritual levels. But down here on earth, as far as we are concerned, better do that than do weightier sins, like going with a woman that's a nida, and other sins that are far weightier than this. So on the one hand, this is very serious. We're not allowed to even cause it. But on the other hand, we say that this is a lesser evil than the prohibition of going with a woman that's a nida. Now, you guys know that every girl is a nida unless she goes to mikveh. You don't have to be married to be a nida. Every girl's a nida. Any girl you're dating is a nida. We say any girl, the second she had her period once in her lifetime, she's a nida until she goes to mikveh. And that's why one is not allowed to touch a girl when he's dating her and of course, not live with her. That's one of the reasons why. There's more than one prohibition on living with a girl before marrying her. But so we have to know on the one hand that this is something we have to take to heart. One's not allowed to let his mind wander. And don't feel bad if every day you feel like you have a bad thought. Chazal tell us that every person every day, at least once, is going to have some thought that's improper. The question is, do we let it evolve or do we control it and say, no, this is wrong, let me think about something else. So, Chazal say, every person is going to have the inkling of a thought once a day, at least. Chazal say, this is one of the things that no one can watch himself. Every person, every day has at least once. But the question is, do I control it or does it control me? I don't let my mind wander. Okay, let's continue.
What about the bearing?
What?
What about the bearing? We discuss the bearing, and if you go outside, you can't.
Oh, we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
Sorry, I thought you were going to the next one.
Now the only problem is that my chumash over here is missing a bunch of pages. Just a second. Give me just a second. I gotta get another chumash. Sorry. You're cold, so shut the air conditioner.
It's keeping me awake, though, I think.
So. I think so, too. So God tells us when we go to war, so let's say a person is impure, that's tumas keri, then he should go immerse in a mikveh. Today, there's no obligation to go to a mikveh. Not only that, if you take a shower that's just as good, it's nice, it's a level of purity, it costs you 10 shekel. When you could do it, it's good. A person who emitted sperm has this tumah, and he could go to mikveh, and then at nightfall he will be pure. So one is not allowed to have sperm on himself. That's considered that he's unclean. One should not pray or make a blessing when he has sperm on himself. But once one is clean, so then this is a level of purity. There's no need to do it ever. Some chassidim are careful to go to mikveh every morning. Some chassidim are careful to go to mikveh only after they had tumas keri. And most people have the custom before Rosh Hashanah to go to mikveh. some go for Yom Kippur as well, and before you get married. So many, many people go to mikveh. There is no need for a man ever to go to mikveh, correct. Except he's a ger. A ger has to go once, biblically. Women have to go after they that's how they become pure. But men never have to go to mikveh. Nowadays, when there'll be a temple, then they do. Okay, Torah tells us we have to have a set bathroom. And we have to have part of the artillery that a soldier takes with him. He has to have a shovel so that he covers his feces. Because God says, I'm among your camps. Your camps have to be holy. And from here we derive this concept, the feces are unholy. When you have a dirty diaper, you're not supposed to make blessings next to it. You're not supposed to pray next to it. You're not supposed to learn Torah next to it. Feces, here we derive. God says, I'm among your camp. You must dig and cover up your feces. I don't want it around there. Your camp is holy. So here we derive the feces are unholy. How so? You can't talk Torah next to it. And this applies to the bathroom as well. If the door to the bathroom is open and you see the bathroom, so then you're not supposed to talk Divrei Torah. You're not supposed to make blessings, etc. You're standing in the subway and there's a yellow puddle next to you and you smell it and you know it's a urine. So you're not allowed to talk or learn next to it. You're not allowed to make blessings next to it. Walk away from it where you can't see it. And you can't smell it. You're 4 footsteps away from where the smell ends, and then you could talk and learn Divrei Torah. Torah tells us, "I am among your camp. Your camp must be holy. I don't want to see your covered parts." From here, we derive that there's an aspect of holiness about our covered parts. This applies to men and women. So, if a man is standing naked, he's allowed to think Divrei Torah, but he's not allowed to talk Divrei Torah. If you're standing in the shower and your hands are clean and you want to think Divrei Torah, no problem. If you're in the shower, provided there's no bathroom in the shower. If it's a separate shower room, thinking Divrei Torah is okay. You're sitting on a bus, and there are women there, and they're not dressed modestly. You could see that from their elbows up, or you could see from their knee up. So then, or their hair is uncovered. Hair uncovered is, well, you could be more lenient, but any other thing. So then, the halacha is, you're not allowed to talk Divrei Torah. You're not allowed to make blessings. But you could close your eyes and make a blessing, or you could look in the sitter where you don't see anything and make a blessing. The idea is you shouldn't see something uncovered, or your own private parts should not be uncovered. A guy's going to say, he's going to the mikveh, he puts a tube around him, and he says, I don't see any uncovered parts. Yeah, but his own uncovered parts are visible, so then he may not make a blessing. The same thing is true if, let's say, you're wearing a robe. You guys saw what Daniel was wearing earlier tonight? You wear a long robe, and this is more applicable to women. They wear robes very often. So if you wear underwear, your private parts are covered. If you're not wearing underwear, you have to wear a belt, something that separates your heart from your private parts in order to make blessings.
Is that where garbage comes from?
A little bit. Yeah?
If it happens in a meter and suddenly someone dumps rubbish or something nearby.
It has to be a very bad smell.
Like the meter to move somewhere else?
Yeah, but usually rubbish doesn't have such a bad smell. It has to be very, 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 very foul. Feces, if you're standing in the Amidah and your son comes next to you and he says, Daddy, I need the bathroom, and then he doesn't make it and he has an accident, you cannot continue davening. If it's possible, wait till your wife or someone else comes and cleans it up. If it's not possible, then you have to move. Yeah. That's not so simple what I said. I said it about herself, about her private parts uncovered. So we say a woman's private parts are more concealed, so there's more to discuss. Meaning if two women are sitting in a room.
Yeah.
So that needs its own discussion. We can't do it in this format.
Can you not keep it? You said elbow and up.
Right. Elbow and up, knee and up. Right. Right? So he's not looking at them. So long as he doesn't see them directly, that's okay. That's the Shulchan Aruch's opinion, and when necessary, we rely on it. That so long as you don't see it directly, that's fine. That's why rabbis, when they're Mesader Kiddushin, when they officiate on a wedding, they'll look down in the sitter or they'll close their eyes when they make the blessing because there are people around who are not dressed modestly, right? And then they're verbalizing, they're saying it like the rabbi giving the shir, right? The Torah tells us, let's say a non-Jewish servant, a non-Jewish slave, runs to Israel and he comes to us and he tells us, I want to be Jewish. So the Torah says you can't send him back and tell him, no, go to your pagan master. You got to help him become a ger and let him live among the Jewish people. The Torah prohibits having prostitution, male or female prostitutes. And the Torah tells us that something that was given as a gift to a prostitute may not be offered as a donation to the temple. The same thing, something that was paid as a price for a dog may not be offered as a donation. The Torah tells us we're not allowed to take interest from one another. We're not allowed to pay interest. So how do we have banking systems? So we discussed the concept of corporations, that prohibition is on individuals. And that needs more discussion halachically, but that's its own discussion. The Torah tells us the concept of lo se'acher. If you take a vow, you must pay up right away. So you go to shul, and you get an aliyah, and you say, I'll donate a certain amount, you should pay it as soon as possible. But ordinarily, the Torah tells us, try not to take vows. A person who takes a vow, it's considered like he sinned. There's the potential for vows. If it's necessary, a person's at a time of danger, so then it's a good idea to take a vow if he feels like he needs some extra merits. But ordinarily, one is better off not taking vows. Torah gives us a special commandment if you have workers processing food. So then you have to let them eat from that food. Just like we know when you have an ox threshing, you can't muzzle it. It's seeing food all the time. You can't tell it, you work, but don't eat. You have to provide it with food. But what you could do is hang a little basket under its face with some cheap animal food. You don't have to let him eat from the great wheat kernels that he's threshing. That's expensive. You could put him some barley kernels under his mouth and let him eat that. But if you have a worker that's processing food, so the Torah tells us you have to let him eat. He's not allowed to put food in his knapsack and take it home, but you have to let him eat from the food that he's processing.
Does it apply to
non-food items? No, this is specifically food. The Torah here gives us the concept of divorce. Until the end of the 40 years, we don't have the concept of divorce in the Torah. Here in our parasha, the Torah tells us there exists a concept of divorce, that one may divorce his wife. And if that wife marries someone else, then he may not remarry her. If she does not marry someone else, so then he has a mitzvah to remarry her. The Torah tells us when a person marries a woman, he has a special mitzvah to make her happy the first year. He's not supposed to go on business trips where he'll be out of the house overnight. The first year that a couple is married, he's supposed to be home every night, he's supposed to build the home with her and make her happy. The Torah tells us, let's say you're taking collateral. So don't take collateral that's someone's livelihood. A guy comes to you and says, I need a loan. So you tell him, fine, no problem. You're a gardener. Give me your lawnmower as collateral, you can have a $1,000 loan. So Chazal say, no, don't take collateral that's going to hold up his ability to work and make a living. Torah tells us if someone kidnaps someone, he gets a death penalty. Torah says we have a special mitzvah to remember what God did to Miriam. And there's a discussion, do we ever fulfill this mitzvah other than when we read this verse? It would seem we should remember it every day. When do we remember this? So some say that when the Baal Kori reads this pasuk, he should have in mind that he's fulfilling this mitzvah. And he's our shaliach. And when we hear it, just like the mitzvah of remembering the Amalek, we're fulfilling it here. So this is the concept. We should remember Miriam. What happened with Miriam? Miriam had a brother that she loved, named Moshe. And Moshe Rabbeinu, after he got his prophecy, he understood from God that he's not supposed to live with his wife anymore. Because we just learned earlier that when one lives with one's wife, he's defiled, he's impure. And when he's impure, he can't have prophecy. And God is always talking to Moshe. So Moshe, even though he and his wife live in the same tent, they are no longer living as husband and wife for the next 40 years. He didn't give her a get, and no one knew that he wasn't living with her. But Moshe is not living with his wife for 40 years. And now God tells Moshe at one point to appoint another 70 elders that they will receive prophecy and they'll help him out. And when Moshe does this, so Miriam is standing next to Moshe's wife Tzipora, and she says, boy, do I feel bad for their wives. So Miriam says, why? So Tzipora says, well, ever since my husband got prophecy, he hasn't been living with me, so I feel bad for their wives. So now we see Moshe's modesty. Moshe never told his wife, hey, you know, I'm not living with you because I'm the greatest prophet that ever lived. God is talking to me all the time. As far as his wife was concerned, okay, Moshe isn't living with me. Must be these other prophets. Are they going to be the same thing? They're not going to live with their wives. Miriam hears this. She turns to the big brother Aaron and tells him, Aaron, we got to talk to Moshe. You and I, we get prophecy. We're still living with our husband and wife. Miriam's still living with her husband. Aaron's still living with his wife. Let's go talk to Moshe, because who does he think he is that he left his wife? Did Miriam mean to speak badly about Moshe? No. She meant to help him work things out, shalom bayis, with his wife. But she did say something. She equated Moshe with herself and her brother. So she was his big sister, speaking to their big brother to help him out with his shalom bayis, thinking that he's doing something wrong. And what happens? Right away God appears. Bam! God says right away, Moshe, Aaron, Miriam, come out, I want to talk to you. Aaron and Miriam had just lived with their spouses the night before. They hadn't yet gone to mikveh. And God appears to them. They start yelling, water, water, we can't handle this. We can't handle this. God, you can't talk to us now. We can't. We're defiled. And they feel terrible. And God says, no, now we're going to talk. And they're not ready for it. So Aaron and Miriam automatically become lepers. A white spot starts emerging on all of them. Aaron looks at Miriam and he sees she's a leper. Miriam looks at Aaron, she sees he's a leper. Why? Because they weren't fit for prophecy and God appeared to them. Why did God do that? God said, oh, you're talking about Moshe. Now you'll understand what Moshe did. You think you're like Moshe? There's no one like Moshe. Moshe is the greatest prophet that ever lived. You equated yourself with Moshe. That's why they got leprosy. So God says, remember the punishment of Miriam. What happened to Miriam? She meant to talk about her little brother. She was talking about good. What did she do? She erred in equating her prophecy to his prophecy. And here we see she really thought they were equals. She thought she'd help him out. And look at what a punishment she got. This is to teach us the importance of being so, so careful when we speak about our fellow men. This is the concept of lashon hara, that we were prohibited from speaking anything that might indirectly cause harm to someone else. And the idea is we learned from Miriam. Look at her. She was the greatest. She led the Jewish people. The Navi says there were three leaders, Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. Just like Moshe led the men together with Aaron, Miriam was his counterpart, his sister, who led the woman. And even so, when she spoke badly about her little brother, look at her punishment. That's supposed to teach us a lesson. So we have a special mitzvah to remember what happened to Miriam. And that's supposed to teach us about how careful we have to be about lashon hara. The Torah tells us if you're collecting collateral, a guy isn't paying up his loan, so you have to respect his domain. Stand outside the door and let him bring you the domain. Let him bring you the collateral. If you took collateral that's something that he needs, you took his blanket, so bring it back every night. You can't say, well, yeah, pay up, I'll give you back your blanket. No, every night bring it back. Every morning he'll take it back and he will bless you. And God says that'll be righteousness before me, that he blesses you. And that's a concept we have to remember. We should try to have people bless us. The Torah tells us don't take things by force. Sometimes you come to a guy, he's your worker, and you tell him, buddy, I want to buy your car. He doesn't feel like he has a choice but to sell you the car. I'll pay you a good price. No, the Torah says, don't force people to sell you things. Don't withhold wages. You have to pay a person. The Torah tells us, don't withhold wages. Let's say a person worked for you today, and you took on a babysitter. That night she worked for you, you have to pay her that night. You can't say, well, I'll pay you tomorrow. No, you owe her money. She worked for that day, then you have to pay her that night. You have that 12-hour period, the next 12-hour period, where you have to pay him. A guy worked by day, so pay him. He worked his life in order to get those pages. That paycheck, you have to pay him right away. How do you get around it? Let's say a guy worked for you and you don't have change. You can't pay him. So Rav Eliyahu gave the advice, pay him one shekel. And then once you started paying him, we consider it as though he gave you the rest of the money as a loan. Once you paid him the beginning of the payment, we say, okay, now you start paying him. How come you didn't pay him everything? The rest, it's considered as though it's a loan by you, and then you could pay it when you can. So that's a way of getting around it if you have to. The Torah tells us you don't execute parents for the children's sins. You don't execute children for the parents' sins, which is a very important concept. The Torah tells us, lo tachvol beged almana. Don't take collateral from a widow. That's her garment that you'll have to bring back every night. And here we have a very important machlokas tanoim. The Torah tells Rabbi Shimon and the sages. Rabbi Shimon, which in the Mishnah is always Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, he says, why did the Torah tell us don't take her garment as collateral? Because if you keep coming back every night to give her back her collateral, all the neighbors will start talking about how she's down and out, how she's so poor. So let's say you have an almana that's Helmsley. Everyone knows she's a millionaire, and you have her collateral, and you have to bring it back every night and take it every morning. So there's no problem. And that's called the concept of Darshinan Taima Dikra. That Rabbi Shimon says we could figure out what's the reasoning of the verse, and once we figure it out, that will have halachic implications. That based upon the reasoning, we will apply when yes to apply the pasuk and when not. And the rabbi said, no, You could figure out, you could think of a reason, and it's a good lesson for you, but you can't say that's the reason and then apply it halachically. And that machlokas revolves around this pasuk, and we apply it elsewhere in the Torah as well. We are out of time, so we're going to have to conclude. We did most of the parsha, and bear in mind, we did up past Shvi'i, so we're almost finished with the parsha. So that means we did almost 74 mitzvot in our parsha out of 613. That's over 10% of the mitzvot of the Torah are in our parsha. It's worth investing time to conclude the parsha. If those of you who wish to have an extra class tomorrow night doing the parsha, we could meet tomorrow night, Bezat Hashem, let me know. We'll take an extra 15-20 minutes and we will conclude the parsha, the mitzvot of the parsha. We have those minutes.